Vikings for Christ. The Scandinavians were the last group of Teutonic people to abandon heathenism and to embrace Christianity. The Viking marauders from the pagan north wreaked havoc throughout northern and western Europe. Throughout the 9th and 10th centuries, Vikings raided, killed, and plundered. They also established strong Viking settlements in Normandy, which is named after the Norsemen who settled it, and England, and Scotland, and Iceland, and Ireland, Greenland, throughout the Baltic, and even in Russia, the Vikings settled. And their key weapon was this longboat, the Viking longboat. Very low keeled, so it could sail up rivers, even up rivers that you wouldn't have thought, like the Humber and the Thames, quite happily. It could go in oceans and survive crossing the whole Atlantic Ocean, no problem, and it could sail up rivers into the hinterland of many countries. Rowing boats, they used sails, but they also could row, and with a dragon normally sticking out in front, these were signs of terror. When people saw the dragons and the square sails heading towards them, people screamed and fled. The Vikings terrorized Europe. One of their sports was running from oar to oar. You meant to keep your oars upright, and a man would jump from oar to oar for balancing from one side to the other. And of course, if you miss, or somebody meanly drops their oar or something, then you'd end up in an icy ocean, and you know, it's extremely cold, like heart attack cold, freezing cold. The Vikings traveled all around, not just the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, and all the way up to Russia. They went down the Dnieper and the Don and the Volga. They went into the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. They went up the Danube. They came down the Rhine River. They were able to travel and loot all the way across the Mediterranean, North Sea, even as far as Iceland, Greenland, and Finland, or what today is called Canada. 500 years before Christopher Columbus, Vikings had reached North America. It took a while for people to realize that, but it's a fact. They started out in the north. Doesn't look like a lion about to pounce down the rest of Europe. The whole Scandinavia looks like the of a leaping lion, and that's what it really was. And so the Vikings all started in Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, but they didn't stay there. They settled a huge amount of eastern England, and they, of course, settled parts of northern Germany as well. They got pretty far into parts of the Baltic, and even the very term Rus, the Rus or the Russians, comes from the red-headed Vikings who came to, and in a real sense, the leaders or the royal family of Russia came from the Vikings originally, even gave the name to it. So the Vikings became known as the greatest seamen and explorers of their time, great traders, but also terrifying warriors, great explorers, went across mountainous seas. Can you imagine in open boats crossing the Atlantic Ocean, which took down the greatest ship in history, the Titanic, but these Vikings were willing to go all the way across, discovering new worlds like Iceland and Greenland and even Canada. They fought the Indians. We've got archaeological evidence of it. The Vikings had settlements in Northern America, and they did come up with the Indians, who must have been pretty surprised to meet these Viking warriors. Alcuin wrote of the shocking Viking raid on the monastery at Lindisfarne, AD 793. Never before has such terror appeared in Britain as we have now suffered from a pagan race. Nor was it thought possible that such an inroad from the sea could be made. The people thought they were safe in Lindisfarne. Behold, the church of St. Cuthbert, splattered with the blood of the priests of God, despoiled of all its ornaments. A place more venerable than all in Britain has fallen prey to pagans. Lindisfarne today is the site of where the Vikings made their first raid on Britain. We normally count the Viking Age beginning at 793 AD. Soon a new prayer was added to the church liturgy. From the fury of the Northmen, O Lord, deliver us. And this was literally added to the prayer book because the biggest terror was the Northmen coming by sea. The sea was no longer your protection. The sea could be a road for invasion. At the time, probably nobody could have predicted that the violent Vikings could be conquered by the Prince of Peace and become some of the most enthusiastic missionaries for the advance of Christianity. That wasn't in anyone's mind back in the 8th and 9th centuries, you can be sure. The Viking era is normally dated from the Lindisfarne Raid, AD 793, to the Battle of Hastings, 1066, when the Vikings took Britain. So the Viking Age started with Danes and later Norwegians attacking Britain, and they settled all kinds of places. York and Dublin, for example, were settlements from Vikings. Although the Vikings are famous for their hit-and-run raids, many Vikings actually settled in the British Isles and deeply influenced English culture. The fact that we have a seven-day week is due to the biblical account that God created the world in 6 days and he rested the seventh. But the days of the week were originally named by the Romans after the seven main celestial planets: the Sun, Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn. That's why we have Sunday, Saturn Day. I've heard people getting hysterical about, you can't have church on Sunday. If you gather on Sunday for worship, you're worshipping the sun, you've got an unforgivable sin, you've got the mark of the beast. The Seventh-day Adventist argument is, so they would rather worship on Saturn Day. Like, what makes Saturn better than Sunday? And so, okay, the old calendar, Sunday, Moon Day, Mars Day, Mercury Day, Jupiter Day, Venus Day, and Saturn Day. Those were under the Romans, the 7 days of the week. But the Anglo-Saxons replaced four of these with the names of Viking deities. Tuesday is now named after the Viking god of war, Tyr. Wednesday is named after the Viking war god, Woden, Woden's Day. So you probably shouldn't have Bible studies on Woden's Day. I suppose having Reformation Society on Thursday is understandable. Friday is named after the Viking fertility goddess Frigg, or Freyday. And so Tyr, he's the German god of war. And notice his right hand is missing. A wolf bits off his right hand, and that's why that holds a shield, his right hand, and a sword in his left hand. The spear is a symbol of justice. Odin, or Woden, was the greatest deity of the Norse pantheon, and he lives in Valhalla, and so on. Thor is the son of Odin, and he's probably the most powerful of the gods. He's got the hammer, and lightning bolts are what comes from him throwing his hammer at earth. And Freya is considered the goddess of love and fertility, the most beautiful of all the goddesses, the patron of crops and birth. She's the symbol of all that's beautiful and sensual, and she loves music and spring and flowers. She's the foremost goddess of the Vikings. So Friday is named after Freya. Many English words have their roots in Scandinavian speech. Anger, die. These are Viking words. Scant, ugly, loose, wrong, low, sky, take. I'm sure they were good at that, take. Window, husband, happy, thrive, ill, beer, anchor. Well, of course, there were sea-faring people. These are all Viking words that just have slipped into English. The word berserk is actually the name of a Viking soldier. So when you say, this man's gone berserk, it means he's acting like a Viking soldier. These people wading into battle with swords or axes acted berserk. And so when you say, you know, stop acting berserk, you're basically saying the person's acting like a Viking soldier. Ansgar was the apostle to the north. When the Vikings were the terror of Europe, God placed a great burden on the missionary young Ansgar. And with his own money, Ansgar redeemed several Danish youths who were slaves. He bought them and he educated them to be his co-workers and bring the gospel to their countrymen. One of my favorite flags in the world has got to be the Danish flag, which we've got downstairs in our reception as well. They adopted the white cross on red, red being the blood of the slain and the blood of Christ, I guess, as well. But the white cross on red, that's the national flag of Denmark. They were the first of the Vikings to be converted, as seen in the flag. Harald, king of Denmark, had been driven from his throne. He sought refuge at the courts of Louis I, the king of the Franks. And while at Louis' court, King Harald heard the gospel, turned to Christ, and submitted to being baptized. On the king's return to Denmark, Ansgar joined the king to preach the gospel to the Danes. At Hedeby, Ansgar built a small wooden church, but persecution forced him to flee the country. Sweden was converted to Christ, and they took the blue flag and put the yellow cross on it, or the golden cross. Again, the symbol being the gold of Christ's crown. Enskar responded to requests now from King Bjorn of Sweden. Early in 9th century, when the Vikings were raiding, plundering, burning the coastal cities of northern West Europe, Enskar narrowly escaped his life when Norsemen burned the churches and monasteries in Hamburg. And with two co-workers, Enskar crossed the Baltic Sea to begin ministering in Sweden. On the way, their vessel was plundered by pirates and they arrived in Sweden destitute. But King Bjorn welcomed the Christians to Sweden and the first church was built in the country. And this cross commemorates where they first landed to bring the gospel to the Swedes. At an assembly of the people, a question was debated as to whether missionaries should be allowed to continue to preach Christ. And this would invite the anger of the old Viking gods. At a critical part in discussions, an old Viking stood up and declared with great force, "It's clear that the Christian God is stronger than Thor." This decided the matter. The missionaries received freedom to continue to preach the gospel in Sweden. Thor is strong enough. He can defend himself. He doesn't need our puny help. If Thor can't beat Christ, it's because Christ is greater than Thor. And evidently he is greater. And they gave many examples of how Thor's idols were displaced and Thor's temples were turned over to the preaching gospel. And if Thor couldn't beat Christ, then obviously Christ is greater than Thor. Now, the Christians at the time looked at the Vikings as God's judgment on a backslidden church. More than any previous invasions by the barbarians or the Saxons or anyone else, the crises faced by the Christian church, by the Viking raids, it brought such desolation throughout the whole of Western Christendom. As the Vikings laid waste to monasteries and churches, they shook the churches to the very foundations. And the people looked and analyzed and saw a decline in faith, a decay in their faith and morals that set in long before the Viking invasions. And many saw the fury of the Norsemen as a judgment of God upon a backslidden and often apostate church. There was resistance in Wessex. Churches and monasteries were destroyed and the clergy and the monks were slain. The church buildings lay vacant until in the south of England, the West Saxons, Wessex, West Saxons, Sussex, South Saxons, Essex, East Saxons. Well, the West Saxons stood firm because they were rallied by King Alfred the Great, who was never expected to be king. He was one of the youngest, but his older brothers all died in battle. He was the scholar. He was being prepared for the ministry. They weren't preparing Alfred for being the king. He was being prepared more for the pastorate. He was a book person, and yet he became the greatest of all English kings, the only king of England to be called great. He ultimately defeated the great Danish invasion. King Alfred the Great is the father of the Royal Navy. To this day, the Royal Navy in England looks at King Alfred as their father because he launched the first of the English Navy. How can you defeat Vikings without a navy? You need to beat them before they even land on your shore. And King Alfred the Great is the father of many schools in England. He was the one who mandated schools for everyone, the Bible being the basis of it. He's also the great lawgiver. The dooms of King Alfred start with the Ten Commandments, with the actual Ten Commandments. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of house of bondage, out of the house of Egypt. You to have no other gods before me. The whole of the Sermon on the Mount, the Ten Commandments, and applying a whole lot of key principles, all of this is part of the common law of England. King Alfred the Great defeated the Vikings in many battles, and he finally compelled the Vikings to be converted. In 878, after King Alfred defeated the Danish army at Ashdown, he required of King Guthrum and 30 other of its leaders, earls, to be baptized as Christians. In 889, another Viking leader in the Lower Rhine region abandoned heathenism, embraced Christianity, receiving baptism in the name of Jesus. Duke Rollo of the Vikings and some of his followers received baptism and created the Duchy of Normandy. And by the way, Rollo is very interesting because he's basically the ancestor of every single royal family in England and Europe. All of them. The royal families of Britain, all the way through Denmark, Norway, and you can go through Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, Austria, all of the royal families of Europe, even to Russia, have the Duke of Normandy or Duke Rollo as a common ancestor. He's the most common ancestor of all the royal families of Europe, which is intriguing. And a Viking, of course. The ethics of Christianity were so radically different to traditional Viking culture, like loving your enemy and things like that. It was so radically different that it took literally centuries for the Scandinavian people to be thoroughly evangelized and discipled. Don't you like this picture? Little Viking kitty with a shield and sword just ready to get up there and practice killing and looting and things like that. One of the chief attractions was the conviction that Christ is a mighty victor. He has risen triumphantly over death. The power of Christ impressed the hardened Viking warriors. In Norway, the king commanded his people to be converted to Christ or be prepared to die. However, in Denmark and Sweden, Vikings were converted more by persuasion than force. Pioneer missionaries Willebrord and Ludiger attempted to take the gospel to the Vikings, but with very little visible success. The most successful missionary to the Vikings was Ansgar. It remained of Ansgar, born of Saxon parents in northwestern France 801, to succeed where others had failed. Ansgar was described as a sensitive child who led a devout life. He experienced visions and dreams, and he possessed a combination of humility, self-forgetfulness, and of undaunted courage, energetic initiative. King Harald of Denmark was baptized 826 in Mainz. Some of the first pagans in Sweden to request baptism include the leader of Birka, an island in Lake Mälar, not far from present-day Stockholm, and not far from Uppsala. Despite serious reverses, violence, and destruction of churches, Ansgar did not give up. He persevered, and soon Danish missionaries were being sent to establish churches in Sweden. Ansgar's faithful work was continued by his disciple Rimbert, who ministered both amongst the Danes and the Swedes, Rimbert being succeeded by Adelgar. There was a lot of opposition and persecution, stopping or slowing down the evangelization of the Vikings. Early in the 10th century, King Gorm of Denmark, a determined enemy of Christianity, attempted to banish Christianity from his realm. Many ministers and missionaries were martyred, numerous churches were burned to the ground. But the Saxons were championing the Christian cause. In the British Museum in London, they've got a recreated shield. And you can see when I've stood there, it's a huge shield. It can stretch from your chin to your toes. Very big shield, not the small ones they use in the average movies. The shields of the Saxons were absolutely quite huge. And these are the kind of masks that were very common in, or helmets, protecting you from the sides, even protecting the face itself. Helmets that we use at times. So these are from archaeological excavations to show exactly how the people were armed. The kind of shields and the kind of helmets. You can see from fragments of shields that they've put together again, the metal hold in the middle where you held on to the handle, and the other parts that are holding the wood together, covered with leather. Wood, leather, metal, all part of the shield. Incredible how Hollywood will have people go all the way to the Holy Land, such as with Kingdom of Heaven, which is probably one of the worst pieces of rubbish Hollywood's produced in many years. And just before the battle, when he's going to need it, he throws his shield away and throws his helmet away. Just before meeting a massed assault of Saracens. So you carry your shield and your helmet 3,000 miles, and just when you're about to need it, you throw it away. Like, why? No warrior worth his salt would have done something to you. The Vikings built this church. This church, which I've been to, one of the oldest church in England, about 1,400 years old. This church was built north of England, and most of the stones came from Hadrian's Wall. It's the north, so they had stone not that far away, and so they cannibalized Hadrian's Wall to build this church in north of England. As the Saxons grew in strength and became champions of the Christian cause, when Henry became king of the Germans in 919, he sponsored numerous missionary outreaches to the Danes. And after his victory over the Danes in 934, King Henry compelled their rulers to accept Christianity. Uni was encouraged by the king to renew the work of Ansgar. Gorm's successor, King Harald, looked with favor upon Uni's attempts to reassemble the scattered remnants of Christian communities on the Danish Isles and bring in ministers to rebuild these congregations. And you can see the military structure, the community, the organization of these communities that were built. This is a typical community in Denmark. You have the ditch, you've got the moat, you've got the stockades, and then you have defensive positions, and within you've still got more defensive positions. and the great halls, communal halls where they slept and had their meetings. You can see limited access points, well guarded, and it was in these communities the gospel made great impact. King Henry's son, Otto the Great, became king in 936 and 962 was crowned Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Under royal favour, the church has experienced a wave of reform with tremendous revival of devotion and enthusiasm. King Harald of Denmark extended his realm to become overlord of Norway, and as he himself was baptised, he encouraged the spread of Christianity throughout his realms. The growth was always despite a lot of opposition. Harald's son Sven attempted to bring about a pagan rebellion against his father, who died in a struggle. Sven severely persecuted Christians and repeatedly invaded England, where he died in 1014. In Sweden, a pagan king, Eric, arose, hostile to Christianity, but the church did continue to grow. The missionary Popo won many thousands to faith, and then Odenkar, a missionary from Denmark, strengthened the gospel work in Sweden. King Canute, I think most people have heard of, sponsored missions in England and Denmark. Under King Canute, the church was firmly established in Denmark. Canute later became king over all England. Under his support, missionaries from Germany established more churches in Denmark. He commanded his subjects to learn the Lord's Prayer and the Ten Commands, and to be in faithful communion with the Lord. The church in Denmark grew, deepened with strong ties to the Saxon church in Germany and England. So King Canute was king both of Denmark and of England at the same time. And originally all the Vikings were termed Danes because most of the Vikings used to come from Denmark. But of course, later many were coming from Norway as well. Many people know of King Canute as the man who attempted to stop the waves and got drenched as a result. That's not totally fair or true. He didn't think he could stop the waves. He did this to show his foolish followers who were saying he had the power to even stop the waves, to show he didn't have the power of the waves, only Christ did. So he had his throne carried onto the shore and commanded the waves not to come, and demonstrated how foolish the thought is that any king's got power over the waves. Only Christ has power of the waves. So King Canute was not foolishly thinking he could stop the waves, as some people tell the story. He was actually demonstrating the stupidity of some of his followers' beliefs. The conversion of the Vikings in Norway was far more stormy than that of Denmark. Throughout the 10th century, Saxon missionaries from England labored throughout Denmark, establishing mission stations and congregations. From the time of King Alfred the Great, the revived church in England experienced a dynamic vitality in their missions to the Vikings, which is quite sensible, because if you don't take the gospel to the Vikings, they're going to come to you in raids. So isn't it more sensible to send missionaries to try and convert your enemies rather than wait for them to attack you? And that was one of the visions that started our mission, Frontline Fellowship. We were having prayer fellowships in the South African Army. We were praying, well, we know that the communists are coming to us with hate and landmines and bombs. Have we ever taken the gospel to them? Yes, the Cubans are coming to Africa. Have we ever taken the gospel to Cuba? How many South African missionaries have gone to Russia? And yes, they're sending hate and communism to us. Have we sent the gospel to them? The best way to fight is to attack. Best form of defense is attack. And so take the gospel to our enemies, and even winning some of our enemies to Christ, so that we became chaplains for Renamo in Mozambique, chaplains for UNITA in Angola, and chaplains for the SPLA in Sudan, training more chaplains and medics, and training people to take the gospel to our enemies, win the Muslims to Christ, win the communists to Christ. This is the strategy of the church through the ages. The English, the Saxons were seeing, we need to win the Vikings to Christ as a matter of survival, not only for the fulfillment of the Great Commission, but it's for survival. And so the Kingdom of Norway's got a tremendous story. The Norwegian Kingdom was the creation of Harald Haarfagre, or Harald Fairhead. He died in 933. By much combat, he had established himself as the overruler of all of Norway. His sons, Erik Bloodaxe and Håkon the Good, don't you think these names are so wonderfully descriptive? Erik Bloodaxe. Wonder what his favorite weapon was. They struggled over the succession. Håkon had been sent to England to study. There he'd been converted, baptized, and discipled as a Christian. Hence he was Håkon the Good. By 935, the young, tall, handsome, athletic Hakon established his supremacy through combat. He's accepted as king of all of Norway. Hakon then attempted to win his people to the Christian faith. Most of his immediate court were soon baptized, but later he sent to England for missionaries, began to build churches in Norway. After reigning 15 years, by the year 950, Hakon proposed to the assembly of landowners that they adopt Christianity. Most of his landowners responded with great hostility and vehemently refused to abandon their own pagan ways. They began to place great pressure on the king to compromise and participate in the pagan sacrifices. Facing open rebellion, King Hakon very reluctantly ate some of the meat in the ceremonial feast organized by his landowners. That's meat offered to idols, of course. Later, after being wounded in battle on his deathbed, 961, Hakon declared his great remorse, tremendous regret over that compromise, and his desire to do penance for all his sins. And ultimately, you could see that as the sword makes a cross in a shape on the shadows on the wall, so the Viking sword predated and anticipated the fact that we're going to be converted to Christ. It was a rocky road. There were many reverses. His nephew, Harald Graafell, succeeded to the throne of Norway. While not as enthusiastic a Christian as Hakon, Harald Graafell did pull down pagan temples wherever he went. But the misrule and bad seasons, bad harvests during his misrule, led to much of the people resenting the faith which he had championed. Sometimes having somebody champion a faith who is bad at his work turns people against the gospel. So a poor Christian can sometimes be a very bad representative and evangelist. In 970, Harald Graafell was lured to Denmark and killed, and King Harald Bluetooth of Denmark, Bluetooth, I don't think he knew much about brushing his teeth or flossing.
I just want to tell you that Bluetooth, you know the technology Bluetooth?
Yes.
The symbol apparently is the symbol of that King Harald Bluetooth.
Well, how interesting. I wonder what these Vikings would think that there's a technology used today that's named after one of their Viking kings who just obviously didn't know much about oral hygiene. But anyway, people want to have a lack of oral hygiene technology, they're welcome. He made himself overlord of Norway and he encouraged Christianity there. And then comes Olaf Tryggvason, the son of the king of Norway, born in 964. His great-grandfather, Harald Haarfagre, the Fairhead, had originally established the kingdom of Norway. But when Olaf's father was murdered in 968, Olaf fled the country with his mother. He was an adventurous youth, to put it nicely. He was captured by slave raiders, sold into slavery. He was rescued, raised in a Scandinavian colony in Russia. Olaf ended up in the court of Russia's Tsar Vladimir I, where he became a favorite of the queen. When Olaf was just 12 years old, the Tsar put a dozen ships under his command and sent them off to battle. 12 years old, isn't that a good time to start your military career? Why not? 12 years old. What else you can do at 12 years old? That isn't a video game, so, yeah. Take some ships to go on a raid, go and see who you can loot and kill. By the time he was 21, Olaf Tryggvason was renowned as the ultimate Viking. He's tall, strong, handsome, unequaled in martial skill. He led a huge army of Swedish Vikings in a fleet of almost 90 ships to loot Holland. Well, after devastating the Dutch, he went to fight the French. He left a massive amount of death and destruction wherever he went. His next target was England, where after the Battle of Maldon near the mouth of Thames, he forced the Anglo-Saxon king Ethelred the Unready, gives you a bit of an idea, Ethelred was unready, to pay a tribute of 10,000 pounds of silver. By the way, a pound literally meant a pound of silver. So the notes they use today, a pound, it was, I promised to pay the bearer on demand 1 pound in silver. And so a pound comes from, and hence the word sterling, 1 pound sterling. So it's 1 pound in silver. I don't think you could do that today, but that's what the promise you had started out with. And so 10,000 pounds of silver, that represents a lot of money, a lot of value and wealth. And this wouldn't have been in paper money, this would have been actual silver, 10,000 pounds, as in we're talking about 5,000 kilograms of silver. After this, he moved north, plundering Northumberland and Scotland. He attacked the Hebrides, the Isle of Man. He conducted raids on Northern Ireland, Wales, Cornwall, and France again. With a fleet of over 94 ships, he again attacked England, killing and looting wildly, which is what Vikings were wont to do. until King Ethelred offered him a further 22,000 pounds of silver. Can you imagine how much it is? Off the coast of Cornwall, all have heard of a local fortune teller who was renowned to have the gift of prophecy. So Olaf rode to this remote rocky retreat and asked the prophet, "Can you foresee anything in my future?" "Thou wilt become a renowned king and do celebrated deeds. Many men wilt thou bring to faith and baptism, and both to thy own and others' good. Let thou not doubt the truth of this answer, listen to this." The old man then predicted Olaf would soon suffer a mutiny from his men, in which he'd be wounded and carried to his ships on his oblong shield, and after 7 days he would recover and he'd be baptized as a Christian. When the mutiny, the wounding, and the recovery happened precisely as the hermit had predicted, Olaf sought the old man again to inquire, "How can you possess such knowledge?" And the man humbly confessed, "The God of the Christians has blessed me." Well, when King Ethelred heard of the conversion baptism of his tormentor, King Olaf, he sent his bishop and officials to present him with royal gifts and to offer Christian fellowship. In 995, news came from Norway that the leader, Earl Haakon, the very man who had murdered Olaf's father, who had caused an uproar in the land by demanding the daughters of respected leaders of the community, and although Earl Haakon had originally accepted Christianity under threat from the German Emperor Otto, he had since reverted to heathenism, restored many pagan temples, and persecuted Christians. Earl Haakon was now an apostate, and he had even gone so far as to offer his best horses and his youngest son, a 17-year-old, as sacrifices to the heathen goddess. So Haakon was an apostate, the evil enemy of the gospel. It was at this opportune time that Olaf, the great-grandson of King Harald Haarfagr, determined to leave England and avenge the death of his father, the exile of his mother, the slavery of his youth, and to end the pagan misrule of Earl Haakon. With just 5 ships, Olaf landed in Norway, claimed it for Christ. Soon word reached him that Earl Haakon had angered 2 landowners by attempting to seize their wives for himself. The growing resistance was greatly strengthened when word reached him that Olaf Tryggvason was on his way to claim the throne and to deal with Haakon. Olaf was renowned as the Viking warrior without equal. His height, his strength, his athletic stature, his superior skills in all warrior arts, his boldness and ruthlessness were renowned throughout the land. While Earl Haakon fled, hidden in a pit beneath a pigsty, where he was killed by a slave. Now, you know, basic Viking understanding of the future, you've got to die in battle. If you don't die in battle bravely, courageously, without any trace of fear, you will not enter Valhalla. I mean, at the very nicest way of putting it. The Valkyries will scorn you. So Haakon, by his own standards, really damned himself for all eternity by having such an ignominious, cowardly death. What can be more ignominious than being killed by a slave in a pigsty while hiding? At the National Assembly, Olaf was proclaimed king of all Norway. He then travelled throughout the land to consolidate his rule and to attempt to Christianize the people. Many of his relatives became his first converts, and he appointed them as Christ's captains. "I shall make you great and mighty men for doing this work. All Norway must become Christian or die." There's that Viking word, die. The scattered settlements on the west and east coast of the Oslo Fjord readily accepted baptism, but the people in the northern part of the Vik resisted the gospel. So King Olaf challenged the followers of Thor and Odin to combat. By the end of the year, he had convinced everyone Christ is greater than Thor and Odin, for sure. As King Olaf moved to the western and northern fjords of Norway, he challenged them to swimming races. Now this is in Arctic cold northern waters, North Sea. This is, you know, swimming in that kind of heart attack cold water, you can imagine. Well, actually, you can't imagine, unless you come from there. Archery contest, mortal combat, which he always won, of course. Olaf's message was to the point, repent or die. Baptism or battle. Those who chose to fight were quickly defeated by Olaf's superior strength and skill. King Olaf declared, "The heathen gods are demons. The power behind the idols are evil spirits, and all sorcerers and those who promote idolatry and heathenism were banished from his kingdom. Those wizards and priests who resisted were killed, and some other incorrigibles he had marooned on a rock far offshore at low tide." So you've got till high tide to get right with God, because by then the water's going to reach you and you're going to drown. Simple. How's that for giving the people a chance? At Trondheim, which had been the stronghold of the late heathen king Earl Hakon, all have burned the heathen temples, destroyed the idols. So the local chiefs rose in rebellion against them. Olaf mustered a huge army with 30 ships anchored off the River Nid. Olaf invited the local chiefs to a feast where he indicated he would be willing to perform a heathen sacrifice, which is what they were demanding. When the chiefs were gathered together, Olaf declared, "If I'm to return to making sacrifices, heathen sacrifice, then I will make the greatest sacrifice of all. I will not sacrifice slaves, I'll sacrifice men, free men. I will sacrifice the greatest of men only." He then named the most prominent leaders of his opposition as the targets of his sacrifice. As the horrified heathen howled in protest, Olaf gave them a strict challenge: baptism or battle. He held 11 leaders hostage until everyone was baptized. At nearby Trondheim, the local chief Einbeard, I can only imagine he didn't wash his beard that often, he demanded that the king offer sacrifices other kings before him had done. Olaf said he'd do so. He walked into the temple and smashed the idol of Thor to pieces with his axe. I mean, that's a sacrifice right there. He then killed Ironbeard, persuaded the rest of the village to abandon the heathen ways and to be baptized as Christians. I suppose the man who's just smashed the idol, survived, and killed their king is not a person to argue with. Further north, Olaf faced the strong opposition of Chief Raud, Raud the Strong. Raud mobilized his army and a fierce sea battle was fought, and all his forces overwhelmed Raud's rebels. Raud then escaped to take refuge in an island hideaway in Stoltenfjord. The narrow channel to the ford was turbulent, and for a week no ship could enter. As Raud mobilized his witchcraft against the king to create storm, Olaf summoned his bishops to read the Gospels and pray, and so by some miracle the ships managed to negotiate the treacherous, turbulent, rocky entrance to the ford. Soon Raud was apprehended and brought before the king. King Olaf ordered him to submit to Christ. He said, "I will not take your property from you, but instead I'll be your friend, if you make yourself worthy to be so." When Raud rejected this offer with vile blasphemies, Olaf had his men force an adder, a poisonous snake, down his throat. You've heard of people washing out a person's mouth with soap for swearing. Well, this goes one step better. Put a snake down their throat. This is the last resistance to Olaf's crusade to eradicate paganism in Norway. Now he focused on winning Iceland for Christ. But before he could do so, in the year 1000, King Olaf was killed in a spectacular sea battle at Skåde. The pagan queen, Sigrid the Haughty, was furious that Olaf had spurned her advances. You know, hell hath no fury like a woman's love scorned. Well, Sigrid mobilized two pagan kings to entrap Olaf off the coast of Denmark. But Olaf died as courageously as he had lived. He rejoiced that he had succeeded in his mission in convincing the Vikings of Norway to abandon heathenism, to destroy the idols, and to commit to following the Christian faith. Another prominent Norwegian king who consolidated the Christian faith in Norway was Olaf Haraldsson. In 1007, when he was just 12 years old, Olaf Haraldsson was sent out as a sea king to raid Sweden. 12 years old seems to be a good time to begin your military career. I mean, what else would you want to do at age 12? So Olaf Haraldsson was sent out, and later in Denmark, Olaf joined forces with Thorkel the Tall, and together they launched raids on Jutland, Frisia, Holland, and England. They tormented the poor King Ethelred the Unready, who had already suffered so much at the hands of his earlier tormentor, Olaf Tryggvason, before he was converted. In 1009, Olaf and Thorkel attacked London and East Anglia. They martyred the Archbishop of Canterbury, plundered the cathedral, Canterbury Cathedral, and thereafter Olaf raided Brittany, France, and Spain. Along the way, they burned Oxford, by the way. Then Olaf had a traumatic spiritual experience. He saw a terrifying vision of Christ. Now, isn't it interesting? So many people want to speak about gentle Jesus, meek and mild. That's not the Jesus who converted the Vikings. It was Jesus, the mighty warrior, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the Alpha, the Omega, the one who holds the power, the keys to heaven, and who can condemn you to hell forever. Olaf abandoned his heathen ways. He committed to becoming a Christian. He was terrified of Christ. He feared Christ. He feared no man, but he feared Christ. In 1015, he arrived in Norway and proclaimed himself king. He immediately proclaimed the Christian faith throughout Norway and built numerous churches, including these stave churches, these famous wooden stave churches, which date to the year about roughly 1000. Olaf became known as the great lawgiver. With Bishop Grimkel, he established the Master Law, not the Monster Law, the Master Law. Most of Norway accepted this, but Trøndelag continued with their pagan practices and incurred the wrath of King Olaf, who descended an area either fining or executing offenders. At Gulbrandsdal, the local pagans confronted him with their huge wooden idol of Thor. So Olaf distracted them by drawing their attention to a bright sunrise behind him as a herald of the Christian god. And as his enemies turned to face the sunrise, one of Olaf's warriors stepped forward and smashed the idol of Thor and revealed that its wood was rotten. And not just rotten, but gold spilled out, large rats which had evidently been living off the food offerings scattered. And King Olaf pointed out, that gold that you're wasting on offerings to Thor's rotten idol would look far better on your wives and your daughters. This demonstration of Christ's superiority over Thor convinced the locals to be baptized. Christ is greater than Thor. As a contemporary report noted, they who met as enemies parted as friends. Sometimes you need decisive action against idolatry. For 12 years, King Olaf ruled Norway and brought Iceland and the Faroe Islands to Christianity. Most popularly, unpopularly of all, though, he outlawed the Viking raids. You know, you've got to love your enemies, do to your neighbours you want to be done unto. So we're not going to be looting, raiding and killing neighbours in England and Holland anymore. Another thing, no, that's just too much now. It's one thing to submit to Christ, nothing to stop killing our neighbours. And this has been considered an essential way of life. Where are we going to get all our goodies from if we're not going to be raiding our neighbours? It was at this point that Denmark attempted to regain control over the previous colony of Norway, and Olaf was forced to flee. In 1030, Olaf attempted to rally his countrymen and to get it back from the Danes. At the Battle of Stiklestad, he was heavily outnumbered, more than 3-1, and Olaf inspired his men with a battle cry, Fram, Fram, Kristman, Crossman, Konigsman, on, Christmen, men of the cross, king's men. And Olaf and his men fought boldly and bravely, but they were overwhelmed by superior numbers. And the Vikings grew to regret their betrayal of Olaf, because the Danish taxes and oppression intensified. They thought maybe they'd get relief from some of the intensity, mainly the fact that Olaf was not letting them raid their neighbours. Now the Danes are taxing him, they realise we would have been better off staying with Olaf. Within a year, Olaf was popularly proclaimed a saint, and his remains were enshrined in Saint Clement. And what he had failed to do in his life, he achieved in his death. He united and inspired his people to win the country's freedom from Denmark, to be united as an independent Christian kingdom. The cathedral in York, which is a Viking settlement in England, was dedicated to Saint Olaf. Olaf was regarded by many medieval leaders as the example of the ideal ruler. A church in Constantinople was dedicated to the memory of King Olaf, and the sword he wielded at the Battle of Stiklestad was hung over the high altar. Olaf is the last Western saint to be accepted by the Eastern Orthodox Church. The Vikings surrendered to Christ. By a combination of pioneer missionary work, royal favour and combat, the ferocious Vikings were convinced to abandon heathenism, to destroy their idols, to abandon their aggression, to cease their violent raids, to submit to baptism, and to commit to following the Christian faith. It's a phenomenal achievement. The Vikings came to be convinced that the Christian God is more powerful than all other gods. They saw how Christ answered the prayers of the Christians. They saw witnessing and miracles and victories in battle. They saw how the Christian kings and missionaries were able to destroy idols and defy the heathen gods and taboos without suffering any ill effects. And they saw their pagan gods were powerless before the all-powerful Jesus Christ. Christ was honored and worshipped as the mighty warrior who had triumphed over all the powers of death, hell, and the grave. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. No one can come to the Father except through him. He is the risen, ascended Christ, the King of kings, the Lord of lords, with all other powers and authorities in subjection to him. He is coming again. He will judge the living and the dead. Yes, all kings will fall down before him. All nations will serve him. And so Scandinavia was one to Christ, as seen by these magnificent stave churches. There's about 100 of them around Scandinavia, absolutely magnificent. They date back roughly 1,000 years. Wooden churches still standing today. That's workmanship. That's excellent workmanship. And so these stave churches are a testimony to the conversion of the Vikings 1,000 years ago. And here's one of the cathedrals, a more modern one, of course, but in Iceland, just symbolizing the triumph of the faith in their colonies. I took this picture in Denmark. This is one of the Viking churches, 1,000 years old in Denmark. Now, plainly, they did not build just some prefab good enough for the next generation. They built for the future. They built churches that have lasted now for 1,000 years, standing as testimonies. This is just one church in Denmark showing you how they built for the future. They built to last. They built so that the stones can cry out. Even if the local generation is forgetting Christ, the stones are crying out that Jesus Christ is Lord. And look at their flags, like the Danish flag. By the way, I took this picture on a mission to Denmark, and Denmark has an interesting law that all education is considered equal. Therefore, your tax money is worth X amount for your child's schooling, and you get a voucher. You can take that voucher to whichever school you want. So if you choose to take your child to the government school, or to a Christian school, or a private independent classical school, or you choose to homeschool, you get the same amount of tax money, because why not? You've paid your taxes, and so each child's education is worth, let's say, 20,000 euro a year, whatever it is, and that money will go to... So if you are homeschooling, you get that 20,000 rand that would have gone to government school, because you're educating your child. You can put that money into building yourself a tennis court or a library, whatever you want. I mean, it's your choice, it's your education. And the local Christian schools are as well equipped as the local government schools. They've got the same quality fields, buildings and so on, because they get the same amount of money, and people tend to choose the Christian schools over the government schools. Now, how's that for a really well-organized education system? In some parts of Europe, like Germany and France and Sweden, homeschooling is illegal. And so there are people I know who live in Denmark so they can homeschool there, but their father works in Germany or in Sweden. And they've got to cross the border. And they choose to homeschool in Sweden because Sweden's the best place to live for homeschooling in Europe. And I mean, you're getting full government money for your education also.
You mean Denmark?
I'm sorry, what am I saying?
Sweden.
I'm sorry, Denmark. Sweden, homeschooling is illegal. It's Denmark where it's free and where they actually get government coupons for education. Now, the prominence of the cross in every Scandinavian flag serves a dramatic testimony to the conversion of Vikings. Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, and what is this one? Iceland. Denmark. Norway, Iceland, Sweden, Finland, and England. This is the St. George's Cross. Most people forget England's also a Viking state, because the Vikings took England in 1066. And as you can see, every Viking country has got the cross prominently displayed. The Vikings came by sea, and many of them decided to stay. Like in 1066, the ones who came to England in the Battle of Hastings. You can see some of the magnificent place that they built. This is in Normandy. And the most famous Viking building in the world is the Tower of London, built immediately after William the Conqueror took England. He built to show we're here to stay. The Tower of London, which has been added to, of course, much since, but that dates back to 1066. The Tower of London. So much history is taking place there. I went on a guided tour of the place, absolutely incredible, magnificent, phenomenal things that you can see, the weaponry, the shields, the spears, the different armaments on display. You can also see when you go to Ireland, what's the symbol of Ireland? Not just the Celtic cross, but these strange towers. Now, these towers were built by the Irish to protect themselves during Viking raids. So they built stone towers, because you can't burn stone, and then the entrance would be quite high up, and then they would pull the wooden ladder in at the end, and they would be able to put their families in there. And okay, the Vikings might loot and burn their village and their crops and so on, but their wives, their daughters, their families were safe in the tower, and when the Vikings left, they could come out again and rebuild everything. So even this famous symbol of the Irish is a testimony to the Vikings coming around. You go to a place like Iceland, and you can see the monuments to the Vikings, sword and axe, and you've got, of course, the cross in the flag. When you go to Iceland, you've got also new cathedrals. You can see the symbolism of the Vikings with the big Dane axe. And you can go as far as Minnesota, and there's monuments to the Vikings who went all the way through to North America as well. And again, you can see how the swords are symbolic also of the cross. And three crosses, prominent cross, and then like the thieves on each side of Christ, you've got two smaller crosses. The Vikings have been certainly won to Christ. And these are some of the great places in history where the Vikings operated, from Lindisfarne to York, big battle at Maldon, Dublin. Dublin was a Viking settlement, York, and so on. How they took the Faroe Islands, Shetland Islands, all these places, Iceland. They call this part in the line leaping down, this, what do we call it, ford? The Vik. And that all Vikings really come from the Vik. But Viking literally means a seafaring warrior or raider. So theoretically, the people who stayed in the Scandinavian countries but didn't go on raids weren't Vikings, by definition. But some are trying to say, well, the name Viking actually comes just from those who lived in that area. But of course, we use it much wider, including for people from Denmark as well. And this is how it looks from satellite. It really does look like a line leaping down on the rest of Europe. Here's some beautiful pictures of just parts of Scandinavian life and pictures of their culture and life and architecture at the lovely kind of clothing, the dirndls, the traditional clothing and wear, people in agricultural lives. Very peaceful homes, and yet they brought such war and devastation all over where they went, but they stayed and made some serious settlements. The terrain in Norway in particular was so inhospitable. You can understand, while summers can be pleasant, the winters could be very unpleasant. No wonder they went looking for new lands. An inspiring place to be, but very, very, very cold in winter. And magnificent riverways. Well, the audio and the video of this presentation will be uploaded soon on how the Vikings came to Christ. I've also got a Facebook page called Vikings for Christ, Vikings number 4 Christ. And it's an outreach. Amazing how many people we can reach through that. So if you're on Facebook, like and share Vikings for Christ. You can almost see the Swedish flag here, the white cross with the blue background, the sky type background. Now, Hollywood has tried over the years to make different depictions of the Vikings. One was called The Vikings, which had Kirk Douglas and Mrs. Hellacher. Just forgetting right now. This 1950s presentation of Vikings was a serious attempt to depict the Vikings, and it was respectful of Christianity and how Christianity started to come in. It showed the paganism of the Vikings. I think it's much better than the new modern Viking series in that it's not anti-Christian. I'm afraid the so-called History Channel is very anti-Christian. So the new Viking series is seriously disappointing, not just because of some serious ahistoric garbage.
But not Tony Curtis.
That's right, Tony Curtis, that's correct. So Tony Curtis and Michael Douglas. And that was Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis. That we've got that film in our library down below, and it's well worth seeing. But the modern Vikings, done by the so-called History Channel, what can I say? The History Channel is to history what National Geographic is to geography, and I could also say what a lot of God TV and Trinity Broadcast Network is to Christianity. It's more like an aberration than the real thing. Because as National Geographic is more anti-Christian than Christian, so is the History Channel, extremely anti-Christian. And quite aside from the fact, what's the first thing you notice about these Vikings? Nobody's wearing any helmets. absolutely ridiculous. Now, I understand many Hollywood films, they don't want the lead actor to have a helmet obscuring their beautiful conifered locks that somebody's been working on, so on. But seriously, no soldier worth the salt went into battle without a helmet. Most deadly injuries happen on the head, especially climbing up the wall to assault walls like Siege of Paris. You know, your head's extremely vulnerable. A person can just push a rock over the edge and crossbow, bolt, arrows. But no, they don't have anybody wearing helmets. That just didn't happen. That's ridiculous. And we know there's all the historic artifacts, they wore helmets, lots of helmets. By the way, none of this, what is called Hagar the Horrible with the bull's horns, that's not historically accurate. But they did wear helmets. As you can see from the well-researched monuments that have been put together of Vikings, they had helmets that would at least protect the head and the nose, and of course your ears and the side. And their shields and their helmets were non-negotiable. You might not have mail armor, linked armor, but they will all have a shield and helmet. To go into battle without a helmet would have been fairly suicidal in those situations. How can you do a shield wall and protect without helmets as well? Now, I'm sure the tailoring department had a lot of fun putting this together, but sometimes you look at some of these people of the Vikings, they looked like more it was designed for Mad Max than this is more honest artwork. They had helmets, they had armor, and the kind of clothes they wore.
Maybe they sent the wardrobe to the wrong film set. They sent the proper Viking stuff somewhere else.
That could have happened. Now, the other thing is, in the History Channel's version of the Vikings, they have them in no form of settlement. So they invade England, then they just have their palms spread out. There's no guard tower. There's no moat. There's no spikes. There's no defensive arrangements whatsoever. And then these evil Christians come in and slaughter the women and children of the Vikings. And the Vikings had no thought of, you know, you invade a country and you don't expect someone's going to attack you. No, every Viking settlement was a protective settlement. We know that. We're digging up still archaeologically. This is how the Vikings set up these settlements. Very deep ditches, lots of spikes, lots of palisades and protections, towers, guard towers, watchtowers. There was no such thing as Vikings going out there not building their settlements in a protective way. And this is the way that we know Vikings set up their settlements. There's none of this people all laid out, please attack us, we're not even thinking of security. And in the History Channel, they have one beloved character who's actually a Christian, and Æthelstan. And some moments you think this is exciting. You start to read scripture, there's some prayer, and you even get the Lord's Prayer, and it looks like Ragnar is being converted and he submits to baptism even, as does Rollo. And you think maybe they're being a bit honest and you're going to get some, but no, it's so anti-Christian that they turn things so badly around that in the Vikings film, they actually have this beloved Æthelstan crucified by the Christians. Now, I can state categorically, no Christians ever crucified anyone. From the time of the conversion, the first Christian emperor, Constantine, crucifixion was banned for anyone. You didn't crucify anyone. Christian rulers have an abhorrence. How can a Christian crucify anyone? And here, they meant to crucify this monk because he had come back with the Vikings. Even though he hadn't denied Christ, they crucified him as an apostate. That is such ahistoric garbage. Just to make you hate the Christians, in History Channel, the Christians are much worse, much more perverse, more treacherous than the pagan Vikings. As for the shield maidens, they've made a whole cult of how the women could fight better and more than the men. And I know that some Viking women did fight and were capable of it, but they're mostly in supportive roles. You can't have a shield wall where women are the main part of the shield wall. And the shield wall is going to collapse if you've got women next to men. They can't take the same weight and strain. Physically, it's just not possible. And historically, while the women knew how to fight if they were on their own, they weren't the main ones in the front line fighting. Now, in this film, they've got a lot of things out of sync. We have the character playing Ragnar. Children are born the same order that they're mentioned. But the other thing is the bizarreness of this shaving your head bald. Why would anybody in a Viking Arctic northern climate who's going on the oceans decide to shave off their head? Just being when I was in the army and my hair was reduced to stubble, it's cold. It's very cold. Why would you deliberately take away protection from sunburn and, well, all sorts of other things, not to mention the freezing cold? A little bit of hair does help you. They grow a beard to protect their face in the cold, but they shave off their head. And then they start throwing tattoos all over themselves. Why would you do that? This obsession with tattoos on the Vikings, it's not borne out by the archaeological evidence that we find. The Vikings might have done some tattoos, but this business of, it looks like a lot of this is anachronism that they're just throwing into it. As for Rollo, they have Rollo, who, by the way, is the man who started the Duke of Normandy and was the ancestor of the William the Conqueror, took England. They have him as the brother, the baby brother of Ragnar, and involved in the Battle of Lindisfarne, 793, which is intriguing because 100 years later, Rollo takes Paris. And he must have been very, very, very old if he was fighting at Lindisfarne, and now he's taking Paris at 100 years later. So there's some real nonsense here going on. They also depict Rollo's baptism as a joke, whereas Rollo was plainly a genuine Christian who seriously was converted to Christ, and the evidence there is huge. But in the History Channel, there's such an anti-Christian prejudice. It seems that this Hearst, who does History Channel Vikings, has decided to make the most anti-Christian twist on everything that he possibly can. The fact is, the Vikings were once a Christ, and the real history is more incredible. So the Viking series, while it's got some good action here and there, as far as history goes, it's less than useful. We've got more details on the reformationessay.org website. On our Reformation Tab and Facebook page, we're continually updating all sorts of things. We've got other resources we can learn about our examples of excellence in history, victorious Christians who changed the world. And I've added in the Soldiers for Christ quite a lot on the Vikings as well. Always be yourself, unless you can be a Viking, then always be a Viking.